This is Audible.
The Big Dacker by Mike Brooks. Read by Harry Myers. Prologue. Like a swamp made of knives, Port Tavar squatted beneath the unlight of its captured sun. The slender, crooked shape of Farrell's Needle towered above all, but it was a hollow and ruined place. Broken windows pockmarked its surface like open sores, and subspires and offshoot towers were truncated or shorn clean off. Lord Farrell had not openly celebrated the death of Asdrubale Vect, supreme overlord of the dark city of Camorra, but the civil war that erupted in the wake of Vect's reincarnation by the blood of friend and foe had claimed Farrell and his territories. Now, Port Tavar, like many other sub-realms of Camorra, was permanently on the edge of even more bloodshed than usual, as rival Archons sought to claim preeminence without exposing their throats to another's blades. The venom transport came in fast and high, then rolled and plunged downwards towards Dimera Thrakes like an aerial predator that had seen a plump avian fluttering obliviously below. She watched it approach, observing the skill of the pilot even as she prepared herself for combat. This meeting was prearranged, the terms pre-agreed, but nothing was certain in Camorra, least of all now. It would be foolish indeed for the Cabal of the Wounding Wind to declare war on her Cabal of the Hollow Heart by attempting to assassinate her, her forces far outnumbered and outmatched theirs. Yet, this was a time of fools. And that was without taking into consideration the possibility that another element had gained access to a Wounding Wind venom and was using it to get close to her. Uklael Gendreth's Cabal of the Burning Red, perhaps. He would clothe his warriors in Wounding Wind colours, so that even if his attempt on her life failed, she might blame the wrong party. Or maybe the cult of the Silver Shards. The witches of the Narrow Downs had hated Dimera since she annihilated their allies in the Cabal of 12 Wounds. Sulmu Kevrine wouldn't bother with further deception. Her fighters would simply emerge screaming their hatred, pupils like pinpricks, as cocktails of combat drugs such as Adrenalite or Grave Lotus thundered through their veins. All things considered, it might seem foolish for Dimera Thrakes to be standing so openly atop the tallest tower of Heartpoint, her home and citadel, but all was calculated risk. The Cabal of the Wounding Wind was small and weak, so cowering in her throne room and making them pass through her guarded halls showed them too much respect. She would meet them on this rooftop with the wind in her hair, as though the mere thought of betrayal was an impossibility, and they were little more than underlings coming to receive routine instruction. Which, in fairness, they more or less were. Besides which, receiving her visitors within would expose them to many eyes, and although many eyes within Heartpoint no longer had tongues capable of forming words, not all her servants could be silenced, and there were other methods of communication. A servant without hands was of limited use, and hands could form script for others to read. Better to keep this meeting brief, so casual observers might not notice it. Her bodyguard brought their weapons up to cover the venom as it screamed in on its final approach. They were Cabalite warriors, true-born like her, each one gestated within a parent's womb and expunged into the world in pain and blood, a fitting birth for a Drukhari, and amongst the finest fighters under her command. Dimera herself stood casually, as though their vigilance was of no concern to her, but her shadow field was ready to activate on a hair trigger and turn her into a bewildering smudge of darkness in which weapons would struggle to find her. It was important not to look paranoid, but actually being paranoid was one of the most important survival skills in the Dark City. Beside her, Enzael Osrai was more obviously tense, but then her seneschal lacked the same protections as her. The venom pulled out of its dive without opening fire, and came to a hovering halt at her eye level. Five shards of midnight disembarked, flowing with the grace of true predators, like black ink with edges of razors. Incubi, arguably the greatest hand-to-hand warriors of all the Drukhari, and some of the most feared in the entire galaxy. They were followed by the red and silver armoured form of Zothar Oridreed, Lord of the Cabal of the Wounding Wind. His cloak swirled around him as his boots landed on the dark stone of Heartpoint, and the bow he gave Dimera was shallow, his smile not without a hint of mockery. Dimera's own smile was knowing. A bodyguard of five warriors from the Shrine of the Last Breath made Oridreed look well-resourced, unless, like Dimera, you knew that this was the extent of his contract with them. Five incubi only. That was all this so-called Archon could afford to retain with his other commitments. The Cabal of the Wounding Wind was barely large enough to bear the title, and other cabals might have taken exception to its impudence at adopting such heirs, had Port Tavar's instability not concentrated their minds on other matters. Oridreed was trying to expand and secure his power base quickly, before his ambition irritated anyone enough for them to wipe him out while it was still easy to do so. That made him ruthless, but ruthlessness was not in short supply in Gamora. It also made him desperate, and that was something Dimera could use.
"Lady Thrix," Oridreed said.
He managed to look and sound haughty, even when offering an honorific, but that was as much a ploy as Dimera's studied nonchalance. Appearances were crucial in the Dark City. The perceptions others had of you could quite literally dictate whether you lived or died. Zothar Oridreed sought to be an Archon, and so, lacking the power or influence to secure that title outright, he had to present himself as an Archon unequivocally, so that the minds of others filled in the gaps. He had to do so even if it risked angering those to whom he claimed to be a peer, because nothing came easily in Gamora. Even death could be remarkably difficult to achieve if you crossed the wrong person, no matter how you screamed and begged for it.
"You're late," Dimera said, inspecting the finish of her right gauntlet.
She could feel Oridreed bristle, but her snub was not as damaging as it might have been. Another reason to be accompanied by incubi to a meeting such as this was that they were loyal only to coin. An ambitious warrior might see his Archon mocked and take it as a sign of weakness, one that could open the way to a knife in the back. But incubi cared nothing for such things.
"Your message spoke of a real space raid," Oridreed said, ignoring her jibe.
He feigned an air of unconcern, placing his hands behind his back and looking around as though admiring the view while they spoke of trifles. But Dimera could feel the urgency that beat within him. He was not naive enough to think that an alliance between their cabals would make him her equal, but it was far from unheard of for small groups like his to enter into an arrangement with a larger one. Serving as an auxiliary force, inevitably viewed as disposable, in exchange for the chance of greater plunder than they could have managed on their own, was a good deal, so long as Oridreed himself could stay alive.
"A real space raid, Lady Thrix," Enzar snapped.
But Dimera waved a hand idly to dismiss her seneschal's correction. That was what he was for, in this context, to remind others of how she was their better, in order for her to appear magnanimous by then ignoring him. Also, as a tempting secondary target for an assassin if they missed their first strike at her, to discourage them from pursuing.
"Indeed," she said to Oridreed, as though Enzal had never spoken. "The world of Shor-Ha."
A true smile split Oridreed's face, narrow lips parting to reveal sharp teeth.
"The Maiden World. You seek sport with our rustic cousins?"
"Not exactly," Dimera said.
"Shor-Ha is under attack from the Arrakia now. The orc brutes have rampaged over it, and our kin have been unable to stop them. I believe the world spirit remains undamaged, but it nonetheless angers me to think of the Children of Destruction despoiling such a place."
Zothar Oridreed's dark eyes regarded her steadily.
I did not know you cared so much about the lands of our cousins. Have you not hunted them yourself before now?
Many times, Dimeris said. She recalled one time in particular, when she had used a lance to impale one of the so-called dragon knights and lift him from his saddle as a venom passed by. The Exodites were not fundamentally different from those who dwelled in Camorra, or their kin from the craft worlds. Indeed, on occasion, individuals would move from one way of life to another. But for the most part, Dimeira thought of them as prey.
That world belongs to the Eldari, and I will not countenance the Arrakia taking it from us. They make poor sport, after all. Their pain receptors are crude and their emotions are blunt. It's barely possible to inflict proper suffering on one before it dies. I would rather keep Shorhar as a more bountiful hunting ground. However, she added, for various reasons, I cannot commit my own forces to this endeavor.
Oridreed's face slid into a knowing expression.
And what of your brother? I hear Lord Dalgar has a particular interest in hunting vermin.
That is not your concern, Enzal said, his tone one of warning.
Dimeira kept her own expression studiously neutral. Dalgar was her junior in all respects, but he was ambitious. He did indeed relish hunting non-Eldari sentient life, but he had also been flattened by the Arrakia chieftain and was currently in the process of having his body regrown in the lairs of the Coven of the Red Harvest. This was not something the Cabal of the Hollow Heart had made public. There was face to be saved, after all, but it seemed Oridreed had heard enough whispers to fish for more information.
My brother will not be joining you either, Dimeira said. If you and your forces were to undertake this cleansing mission for me, you would not find me ungrateful.
She trusted Oridreed to read her intent. When Dalgar recovered himself, he would want to find the Orc in question and exact revenge, as much to reclaim his own honour as anything. If the beast that had so embarrassed him was already skinned, then he could not do so, which would lower his standing. If Dimeira did it herself, she was obviously interfering, and it would be seen as a direct slight. If the Orc happened to fall to an unrelated raid from a different cabal, there was nothing to be done. And if that cabal happened to be a minor one, barely worthy of the name, it would make Dalgar's ignominy burn all the brighter. Secrets never stayed buried for long in Camorra, and this could go some way to tempering her younger brother's ambitions for a while. Oridreed had wit enough to see that, at least. Taking Dalgar's kill would earn him an enemy, but one unable to pursue his vendetta openly without admitting to his own shame. And to be sure, there were plenty of ways of pursuing vendettas through covert means, but that was simply how life went in Camorra, and, indeed, often how life ended. In addition, Oridreed would gain a more powerful ally in Dimeira, which was the sort of legitimacy his would-be cabal badly needed.
The gratitude of one such as yourself is never to be shunned,
Oridreed said, with a sweeping bow whose purpose was more to display his armour, cloak and grace than to honour her. Dimeira suppressed an amused smile. If Zothar Oridreed thought he could impress her into making their alliance one bonded through marriage, then his judgment was worse than she had envisaged. It would serve no purpose to turn him down directly at this juncture, though, so she contented herself with raising an eyebrow.
However, Oridreed said as he straightened, there are certain practical matters that must be discussed before we may proceed.
Bargaining, of course. Dimeira humoured him well enough, conceding the use of three of her raider transports, and passing no comment on the fact that some of the warriors under his command apparently had no vehicles of their own. She haggled hard enough over the division of spoils that their transactions seemed genuine, but not so long that she came across as miserly. He was the desperate one, after all, whereas she was playing the role of the Master Archon with near infinite resources. When Oridreed leapt back up onto his venom with another swirl of his cape, flanked by his black-clad bodyguard, he wore the smile of someone who felt he could see a promising future unfolding.
He will seek to use the details of this arrangement against you, my lady,
Enzal said into her ear as they left the roof, his voice pitched so low that even her Kabbalite warriors would not hear him.
"You lack subtlety."
Dimera heard the old retainer's voice echo back through the years from her childhood, from when he could phrase his criticism more harshly.
"And that will be your death."
Enzal's spoken words were true. Oridreed might value his alliance with her, but if he felt it would benefit him, then he would sow seeds of internal conflict in the cabal of the Hollow Heart with rumours of what he had done and why, and at whose bidding. Indeed, at the right moment, he might try to buy his way into Dalgar's favour with the truth of how he had come to be hunting Orc on Shorehar.
"That is only a problem if he survives,"
Dimera whispered back. Chapter 1 Uff tacked Blackhawk's head hurt, and he blamed the thinking. He'd never put much faith in thinking before. It was the sort of thing mech boys did or war bosses. He'd never had much time for it. Well, he'd never needed to. He'd been a regular Orc in Badgit Snazhammer's mob, going where his boss told him and stomping anyone who got in their way. Then he'd lost most of his body and Badgit had lost all of his head, and Doc Drosfang had stuck one on top of the other to give Uftak a bigger body than he'd had before, and also the Snazhammer which had given Badgit his name. Uftak took over as boss, and then that scrap on Hephaesto happened and the Mechlord made Uftak a big boss. Uftak had led his boys through all sorts of fights since then, and they got bigger and tougher as they went. That was only natural. One of the weird things about Humies and the like was that you couldn't always tell which one was in charge, because most of them were about the same size. But as he got bigger, Uftak had begun to notice other changes. It was the thinking. It was happening more often, sometimes when he didn't even mean to do it. Snuck up on him, it did, like a sniffer squig stalking a grot. What was even worse was when he realised that he was thinking about thinking. That was pure unnerving. Right now, he was thinking about the planet he and his lads were on. His part of the Tekwar had landed on it merrily enough, but they hadn't found much. There are a bunch of scrawnies here, those skinny gits with pointy ears what stuck you with sharp things and then skipped away before you could get them a good walloping back. But these ones were unlike those Uftak had encountered before. Their guns were less sippy, and they rode around on massive beasts the size of squiggoths instead of hovering whatnots. That had made for a few interesting fights, but there was nowhere near enough scrawnies to go round. The Wah hadn't explored the whole planet yet, but Uftak had little hope of finding anything other than what they'd encountered so far. Isolated communities of scrawnies that fought gamely enough in their weird way, but just got overwhelmed by weight of numbers. It wasn't satisfying. The lads were itching for a good scrap, but Uftak was increasingly doubtful that they were going to find it here. However, there was something intriguing about the planet. A small group of spikies, which were like scrawnies but with, like, knives on their armour and more hooks and stuff, had shown up one day. Uftak and his lads clobbered them well enough, but the boys in orbit swore to Gulk and Mork that no ship had come or gone. Somehow, a whole mob of spikies appeared on the planet for a scrap. Then the ones the boys didn't manage to properly squish legged it again, all without a ship. And then there was the Grot. What was its name again? Bars? Uftak looked up from where he'd been idly fiddling with the worky bits of the Snazhammer while he did his thinking. Nizquick was practically vibrating with excitement, which presumably meant the Grot had something important to tell him, or at least something it thought was important. Lurking behind Nizquick was the other Grot, the one they'd found. Snaggy. That was its name. Snaggy had been convinced that it arrived on this planet through a giant pale archway of something which looked a lot like scrawnies had made it, and that they only worked when a scrawny was nearby. Unfortunately, Uftak had not yet been able to keep a Scrawny alive long enough to get it to the archway and see for himself. He'd considered setting a bunch of lads to watch the damn thing in case anything else came out of it. There was that thinking again, taking him by surprise. But orcs would get bored and wander off, and Grotz couldn't be trusted.
What?
He demanded, hefting the snazhammer to remind Nisquik of how readily a clobbering could be heading its way if he felt it was wasting his time. Or, to be fair, if he just felt like it.
The Mech Lord Shouty Box is shouting, boss,
Nisquik reported, hopping from one foot to the other with excitement.
The Boffin said so. You gotta come at once.
Uftak grunted and stood up to his full height. There was quite a lot of that now. The top of his head nearly brushed the ceiling of the old gargant head he'd taken as his personal living space, and he'd outgrown the fancy beaky armour he'd nicked on Hephaesto to the point that it was more of a collection of plates strewn around his body these days. He couldn't help but wonder if he was as big as the Mech Lord now, but the biggest Big Mech had sent Uftak and his lads over to this bit of the galaxy to do a bit of stomping and find some shiny loot, so Uftak hadn't laid eyes on his war boss in a while. He got to the doorway and lashed out with a steel-capped boot, connecting solidly with Nisquik's ribs. The grot flew backwards and then tumbled down the side of the hill on which Uftak's bunker sat, emitting amusing noises of pain as it did so.
I don't got to do anything,
Uftak shouted after it.
You just remembered that.
He squinted down at Snaggy, who had the sharp-toothed grin of any grot that had just seen punishment dealt out to someone or something else.
Oi, is it true?
Yes, boss,
Snaggy said, his grin disappearing as it looked up at him. Uftak grunted. Snaggy bothered him, but he couldn't quite put his finger on why. It was tempting to smash the little git anyway, just to be sure, but if Uftak were to smash every grot that bothered him, then they soon wouldn't have any grots left, and then who would do all the boring stuff? He whistled instead, and a high-pitched squeal that rapidly descended, in height if not in tone, announced the arrival of his pet squig, Princess, as it hopped down from where it had been sunning itself on top of the bunker. Snaggy, a fast learner in at least some respects, immediately took off as fast as its little legs would carry it, with Princess bounding along behind, making the happy noises of a squig that had a friend to play with, or possibly lunch. Uftak picked up his shock rifle, clamped the snazhammer to the sticky metal backplate the Boffin had made for him, and sauntered along behind, covering the same distance with one casual stride as Snaggy did with half a dozen panicked ones. The Boffin was buzzing around on the single wheel with which he'd replaced his legs, and tinkering with a truck of some sort amidst the piles of scrap and apparent junk that served as his workshop. Uftak recognised the glyph that denoted the truck as belonging to Scumdreg, and without him even asking, his brain threw up how many boys Scumdreg bossed and what weapons they'd had the last time Uftak had seen them. He grunted in irritation at the unwanted cranial intrusion, and the mech boy looked up.
Boss,
he said excitedly, throwing the still-whirling handheld buzzsaw casually over his shoulder. One of his grots ran desperately to catch it with the despairing expression of one who had taken too many kickings for being insufficiently attentive, and lost an arm as the blade sliced through flesh and bone with ease. The grot stifled a high-pitched squeal of agony, managed to shut the saw down and place it within easy reach of its master, then fainted.
The shouty box is shouting,
Uftak asked.
That's right,
the Boffin said eagerly.
Come on, I'll show ya.
He buzzed away, leaving Uftak to follow him deeper into the mess of his workshop. They passed what had once been, or possibly was going to be, a killer can, heaps of old shooters, and what looked to Uftak suspiciously like the head of a tin head. He glared at it distrustfully, but it showed no sign of either fading away or regrowing its body and trying to kill him, so he reluctantly assumed that the Boffin knew what he was doing. Demetclaude's shouty box was right at the back. Uftak had always wondered whether he should have kept it with him, since he was the big boss after all, but the thing made him uncomfortable in a way that little else did. Anyway, at the end of the day, it was a mech boy's invention, so it seemed only right that a mech boy should look after it. It was a metal effigy of an orc's head, hooked up to all manner of wires and things that bubbled and went blip at irregular intervals. That in itself wasn't too disturbing. What bothered him was the fact that inside the metal skull was half a weird boy brain. The other half was still in what was left of the weird boy, who was kicking around on Demetclaude's ship. Demetclaude having learned about the Humi practice of talking across the galaxy by having one of their weird boys shout with its brain to another one in a different place, and figuring that having one weird boy in two places was more efficient. After all, that way it was the same brain just talking to itself, wasn't it? The boffin flicked a switch, and the speaker that took up the metal mouth crackled into life and began disgorging a familiar deep voice.
Uftak, get your lads together and get back here. We've found a proper good scrap. We're near a star what's all big and red with a smaller one that's a bit more yellowy. You can't miss it. Also,
Demetclaude's voice continued in a slightly more menacing tone,
make sure you bring all the loot you've nicked with you. You've been away for a long time. I want to see what you got.
The speaker crackled again and fell silent. Uftak looked at the boffin.
That's it? That's it, the boffin confirmed. I can make it say it again, but it don't say nothing else.
Uftak grunted. Something about this wasn't sitting quite right with him, and although he distrusted thinking, it had its benefits on occasion. Demetclaude had sent him out here, pointed him at a patch of sky and told him to find out what was there, and he'd barely discovered anything worth fighting, let alone anything worth nicking. Scrawnies usually had quite fancy tech, although it tended to be a bit flimsy, but these ones were like the snake bites of their kind, all monsters and sharp sticks and not a lot of zoomy dacca. Demetclaude was one of the smartest orcs around, and he'd always been good at leading the techwar to the right places for good fights and good loot, but for some reason he'd sent Uftak off to a nearly empty part of the galaxy. Now he was calling Uftak back and making a big deal about the loot he was expecting as a result, even though there was none to be had. It was almost as if Demetclaude wanted to make Uftak look bad.
So we going?
The boffin asked. Uftak opened his mouth to give an affirmative, because of course they were going. Demetclaude was the war boss, and he was calling them back for an almighty scrap. But he was interrupted by a new and far more interesting sound. Orc camps didn't have sirens like Humi ones did, which started blaring as soon as they saw an orc to make sure that the Humis inside were all properly panicking by the time the boys arrived. For an orc, anything worthy of note was greeted with dacca, either shooting at it or just shooting into the air on the reasonable assumption that other orcs would come over to find out what was going on. And it was this that erupted from outside the boffin's workshop. Uftak raced out into the open with the boffin keeping pace with him on his wheel. Overhead, the sun was blotted out, not by one of the mighty storms that rolled across the camp from time to time, but by sleek, narrow shapes screaming from the sky. Uftak recognised them even before they started spitting flecks of toxic crystal, even before the repelling lines rained down and lithe, sharp-edged shapes in red and silver began to descend with notably un-orcish grace. Uftak grinned. The spikies were back. He flicked the whirly bits of his shock rifle with his finger to make sure they still whirled properly, then activated it. The weapon powered up with a pleasing whine, and Uftak fired it upwards. He didn't aim it as such, but quite a lot of the sky was filled with spikies, and a pointy helmeted figure disintegrated very entertainingly, along with the line it had been holding onto. The four figures that had been dangling beneath it suddenly found themselves dropping unexpectedly to the ground. Being spikies, they landed on their feet with sickening agility, but Uftak had already stowed the shock rifle and started moving. It was the only way to deal with them, really. Many and all could try to out-dacker a spiky, but the Gits were good at shooting, and although their guns were disgustingly quiet and the ammunition didn't even explode when it hit something, they could still bring an orc down in short order. Spikies didn't like to hang out miles and miles away and drop enormous shells on you like humies did, nor did they want to get close up and in your face like the bug eyes. Spikies like to move fast and hit hard, staying just out of range of retaliation, because they really didn't like it when you hit back. Uftak crashed into these four like a smasher squig that had just been zapped by an electro prod and began laying about him with the snazhammer. He broke one in half with his first swing and sent it flying. The others drew long, thin knives, but Uftak could practically smell their panic. They'd intended to dangle from their lines and dacker his lads from above, and now they were on the ground facing an angry orc. Scrawnies in general always seemed to think they were so much better than everyone and everything else, but that usually only lasted until you could lay a hand on them. He grabbed one by the head. It tried unsuccessfully to twist away from his grasp and did manage to stab him in the arm. Uftak hurled it into a third one and they both went down in a heap. The last one turned to run, but Uftak clobbered it from behind with the snazhammer and set about pasting the other two. Spikies were annoyingly fragile, and Uftak's little scrap was over in seconds, but battle had been joined in earnest around him now. One of the floating trucks abruptly lurched downwards and crashed as a tractor cannon's beam latched onto it and hauled it groundwards, and another one began to veer as a couple of rockets from a mob of tank busters struck it more or less centrally. Most of the rockets in the fuselage missed, naturally, but given there were many more floating trucks beyond the initial target, it was fairer to say that they were only temporary misses. His lads weren't having it all their own way, of course. He caught sight of half a mob getting raked with fire from the spiky's pointy rifles, then falling over, foaming at the mouth within seconds. But neither were the spiky's. Uftak grinned. He'd been dying for a proper scrap. And at last it seemed as though the galaxy was going to oblige him. Chapter 2. The spikies were gone, or at least they were working on it. Dropping down into the middle of the camp with knives out and guns blazing was a bold tactic. Uftak would give them that. It was also a highly successful one, if successful meant starting a massive fight leading to a lot of casualties, which was certainly Uftak's definition. However, he thought it likely that the spikies hadn't meant so many of those casualties to be on their side. It had probably been intended as a shock assault, a plan to break the wire's will and send them scattering, then pick them off. Uftak wasn't an expert on spikies, but he knew they were a bit weird and liked to stick their knives into things that weren't fighting back, which always seemed pointless to him. You might as well just go and shoot rocks. Which, fine, could be amusing for a while, but the point of a fight was the fight, where your blood was pumping and Gawk and Malk were roaring in your ears. It wasn't fun unless the other git was looking to take your head off in return. Anyway, the spiky's plan had backfired. Instead of shaking the lads up and sending them running, the gits had been swarmed and stomped from all sides. There hadn't been enough of them for their plan to work, and they hadn't hit hard enough. All types of scrawny seemed to approach the galaxy as though it should automatically behave as they wanted it to, and got very miffed when it didn't. What was left of these ones had finally worked out that things weren't going their way, and were making a break for it in their silly floating trucks.
"After them!"
Uftak roared, shaking the snazhammer to dislodge the limp spiky still stuck on the axe blade. This one seemed to be the boss, in that it had been very stabby and had a fancy red rag flapping around behind it. It had left a fair few lads missing a limb or their guts or a head, Its sword had even gone right through Uftek's armour and into his shoulder. But it wasn't a wound that was going to put him down, and the spike, he hadn't got the chance for a second go. The strange, skinny little thing slithered off the snazhammer and landed wetly on the ground. Its insides on show for all to see, just as Uftek's customised truck careered to a halt beside him.
"Morning, boss,"
Mogrot Redtooth beamed from behind the wheel.
"Thought you might need this."
Mogrot was a good driver, deadly in combat, and boasted the intelligence of a concussed brick. He wasn't Uftek's second in command, so much as an ambulatory accident in waiting, who could easily be persuaded to happen to someone else. He was all brutal, no cunning, and as a result was one of the boys Uftek trusted the most.
"Good work, Mogrot,"
Uftek grunted, pulling an arm off the spiky and climbing up onto the open rear of the vehicle. Normally, he might have a few of his best lads in here with him, some of the nobs who like to hang around with their own kind. But at the moment, the only other occupant was Nisquik, who waved nervously at him and then shrank into a corner in case the reaction was another kick. A high-pitched wail, increasing in volume, announced the arrival of Snaggy. The little grot made a running jump for the rear of the flatbed and pulled itself desperately aboard just before Princess landed behind it with jaws wide open.
"Princess, down!"
Uftek barked and threw the spiky arm into the squig's mouth. Princess began crunching joyously, its jaws apparently powerful enough to get at the meat even through the armour surrounding it, and lost interest in Snaggy.
Thanks,
the grot stammered, although it looked as if it had swallowed a sour squig. Uftek banged on the panel dividing the flatbed from the cab, and Mogrot accelerated away, following the rest of the Wah's vehicles that were already in pursuit of the fleeing spikies.
"Do you know where these gits are going?"
Uftek demanded, pointing a finger at Snaggy. The grot shrank back from the digit while still clinging to the handhold, preventing it from being shaken loose by Mogrot's driving, and shook its head.
"No, boss."
"I reckon I do,"
Uftek said.
"Reckon they're heading for that arch thing what you said you came through. That's why Princess ain't eating you yet. You might come in useful."
"Good thinking, boss,"
Nisquik piped up, then subsided again as both Uftek and Snaggy glowered at it. Mogrot was gunning the truck's engine fiercely, keeping pace with the various speed freaks giving chase to the fleeing spikies with whoops and indiscriminate dacker. The whole camp was in motion now. The flyboys had taken off and were screaming overhead in their snub-nosed aircraft. The stompers were grumbling into life and starting to thud forwards with ground-shaking steps. And every foot slogger was flinging themselves aboard whatever truck or battle wagon they could find in order to keep up. Having been denied a proper fight for so long, Uftak's lads were not intending to let this one get away from them that easily. The spikies were like grots who had prodded a giant nest of buzzer squigs and were now desperately running for the water. The only difference was, Uftek intended to see if buzzer squigs could swim, or something like that anyway. He still wasn't properly used to this thinking stuff.
"You said the gates only work when there's a scrawny nearby,"
he said, directing the words at Snaggy.
"Think so, boss,"
the grot replied.
"How long do they take to start working once the scrawnies are near them?"
"Dunno,"
Snaggy said. It edged a little bit farther away from Princess, which had finished its snack and was eyeing the grot hungrily.
"Things was a bit weird in there, and I was concentrating on getting out."
"Grots,"
Uftek grunted.
"Never any soggy news."
Still, at least his hunch about the spikies seemed to be correct. They were heading directly for where he knew the archway to be. If it was just like a doorway to them, then there might not be much hope of catching them. They could probably keep their lead and be through. If it took a while, though, then it might be possible to pin them down and finish them off before they got through the gate and back to wherever they... Uftek's train of thought veered off suddenly, as his thinking rapidly diverted it in a different direction.
Back to wherever they came from.
Where was that exactly? Wherever it was, it would probably have a lot more of the gits, and that smelled like a cracking fight. Even better, Spikey's had all those fancy gubbins, and while Uftak had limited interest in them himself, it was the sort of stuff that fascinated the Mechlord. A half-smashed floaty truck probably wouldn't count as decent loot to haul back to the rest of the Tekwar, but who knew what the Spikies had in their camp? He took a decision. The Mechlord had said that Uftak and his boys should come and find him, but he hadn't said how quickly. Now, you could certainly infer that he'd meant as soon as possible. That was definitely an interpretation you could make from his words and tone of voice, but he hadn't actually said it, had he? And Uftak owed his lads at least one decent scrap before they headed back. Otherwise, they'd all think that only the Mechlord could be trusted to get them a good fight, and that would never do. That would undermine all of Uftak's hard work to become a big boss. Besides, if the Mechlord wanted good loot, then Uftak pretty much had to try to follow the Spikies and nick something impressive from them, because there weren't many other options around. All in all, Uftak decided, in order to properly obey his war boss's order, he'd have to do something else first. Take the lads on a trip so they could let off steam by trashing a new place and stomping whoever took issue with that, and swipe a few interesting-looking gadgets or shooty weapons while he was there. Now he just had to hope that his lads didn't manage to completely clobber the remaining Spikies before they opened that gate.
Mogra!
He bellowed.
Hit the button! Yes, boss!
Mogrot shouted back gleefully and hammered the big red button De Boffin had installed for just such a purpose. The truck's booster rockets, scavenged by De Boffin and his spanners from a fighter bomber that a flyboy had foolishly left unattended, spluttered once and then roared into full power. The truck shot forward like a scalded swigog, and the ride got so rough that even Uftak's teeth were clashing together in his head. Snaggy and Nisquick wailed as they desperately tried to keep themselves from being bounced over the side, and Princess clamped its jaws around one of the roll bars and held on grimly while its legs and tail waggled around in the wind. Say what you liked about Mogrot, and Uftak frequently did, but he knew how to handle a vehicle. He managed to weave the truck's substantial bulk between the other buggies and tracks, albeit out of a desire not to reduce his speed by colliding with anything, rather than consideration for the other drivers, until they were right in amongst the leaders of the chasing pack. Now Uftak could see the Spikies floaty trucks again, three of the ones that carried their boys into the scrap, one with some of those guns what spat out bolts of darkness, skinny weapons that looked as though you could break them over your knee. But Uftak had seen what they could do, and you had to respect something that killy, even if it was weird. And two of the little nippy flyers that zipped around so fast you could barely hit them even if you aimed, and which left strange afterimages on your vision so you couldn't be sure where they were at any given moment. A buggy to Uftak's right looked set to test that theory through sheer volume of firepower. Uzdreg, one of De Boffin's spanners, was swivelling a multi-barreled monstrosity of a gun back and forth, trying to draw a bead on the fleeing gits. He pulled the trigger with a cry of equal parts joy and bloodlust, and red-hot ballistic death flashed out towards the Spikies with an impressively thunderous roar and a truly stunning lack of accuracy. The nearest little nippy craft escaped the hail of ordnance entirely, although one of the larger floating trucks got clipped by the very end of the fusillade, just before Uzdreg's magazines ran dry and clicked empty, one after another. Uftak pointed his shock rifle in the general direction of the floaty truck and pulled the trigger, just as Mogrot hit a particularly insistent bump. The impact jolted his arm wildly, and the blast of shocker energy flew well high and wide of his intended target and blasted right through the smaller git, which suddenly found an entire section of its core snatched away into the warp, possibly along with a few limbs of the crew. That was clearly enough to overcome its strange resistance to gravity, and it arrowed downwards to smash into the dirt with a definite finality.
"Stomp 'em good and proper!"
Uftak yelled back over his shoulder, and a fair few of the vehicles in his wake veered off to give whatever remained of the spikies a right good kicking. It wouldn't take the boys long to finish and catch up, but that was a few less to concentrate on the ones still getting away. Telling his lads not to try and kill the gits didn't even occur to him. He wasn't a blood axe. But getting them to focus on killing ones that didn't matter to his overall plan was fine. That was just sense. The spikies weren't going to take this lying down, though. Two of the weapons on their floaty gun wagon swiveled around to face backwards, and two beams of darkness stabbed out to converge on Uzdreg's buggy. It disintegrated instantly, the edges clattering to the ground or rolling away, and the middle, including Uzdreg and whatever poor sod had been driving him, blasted into utter nothingness. Uftak fired back on the basis that the gun wagon was the only thing doing anything except running away. But Gawk and Malt weren't prepared to grant him good fortune a second time in a row, and his shock rifle shot missed everything. The spikies veered off to the left suddenly, pulling the sort of sharp turn that should have been impossible without friction between ground and wheels. They were heading for a raised area of broken rock over which their strange technology would carry them with ease, but which would serve as an effective barrier to the orcs following in their wake. Time for thinking to earn its keep.
"Leave 'em,"
Uftak roared, throwing all the volume he could into his voice and pointing forward.
"They're trying to lose us, but I know where they're going. Follow me, lads."
He leaned down.
"Mogra, you remember where that weird arch thing is?"
"Yes, boss,"
Mogrot replied, although his eyes were fixed on the fleeing spikies and every muscle in his body was tense with the effort of not turning the truck to follow them.
"Get us there fast as you can,"
Uftak said smugly. It was a risk, Uftak knew that. If he was wrong, the lads were going to be furious with him. However, he trusted both his own cunning and Mogrot's driving skills, and it was borne out when they rounded a grassy ridge and saw not only the pale curves of the strange scrawny architecture reaching up into the cloudless sky, but also the red and silver shapes of the spikies' vehicles heading for it as fast as they could. They'd taken an indirect route in order to shake their pursuers, but they'd reckoned without Uftak Blackhawk, and now their lead was slenderer than a starved grot.
"What now, boss?"
Mogra asked as they tore across the ground.
"They're going to go through there,"
Uftak told him,
"and we're going to go through it behind them."
"What's on the other side?"
Mogra asked, his brow wrinkling as he tried to come to terms with the concept of something he couldn't see.
"Something we want to fight or steal,"
Uftak said confidently.
"Or fight and steal."
The remaining smaller craft, the floaty buggy, made it to the archway first. The empty air within the structure's outline shimmered and became a surface of glowing light into which the spiky vehicles disappeared one after another. Uftak suddenly realised that he had no idea how long the gateway would remain active after a scrawny went through it, but there was nothing to be gained by slowing down to find out. He raised the snazhammer for all behind him to see, lifted his head to the sky, and roared out his praise to Gawk and Malk for the adventure on which he and his lads were about to embark. The gateway got closer and closer, and larger, and then... Chapter 3. Dimera had always been fascinated by why the homunculus covens tended to choose underground locations for their lairs. This was Camorra, after all. It was hardly short on space, and its alternative name of the Dark City indicated that it was not overly afflicted with intrusive light. Perhaps it was down to justifiable paranoia, a desire to absolutely know where the entrances and exits were, and to minimise lines of sight for long-range assassination by hex rifle. Then again, Dimera's own paranoia much preferred multiple exits to being stuck behind a bottleneck, and assassination should be low down on the list of concerns for Drukhari, whose mastery of flesh, both others and their own, was so complete as a homunculus's. It was a mystery, although not one which she currently had the leisure to interrogate. The coven of the Red Harvest's underspire was a bewildering labyrinth of strange angles and distorting mirrors. Dimera had a fine-boned face, and her eyes were lined with dark coal made from the ashes of defeated enemies, but she walked past some reflective walls that made her appear skeletal, with sunken cheeks and eyes no more than empty pools of shadow. Others twisted her posture so that she looked as hunched and malformed as the masters of this place, while still others overlaid a sheen of decay on her image, as though her living flesh was the victim of some hideous disease. It was all designed to unnerve and intimidate the outsider, be they guest or intruder, and not so subtly remind them of the power wielded by the coven in whose domain they were treading. Dimera had no doubt that the Red Harvest could, if given free rein over her body and immunity from reprisal, alter her flesh to resemble any of the images she saw as she walked through these halls, or indeed many other even more disturbing visages. What gave the whole thing a slightly different note of concern was that the reflection of her guide, a nameless multi-armed rack with the swollen musculature and enlarged, protruding spine typical of its kind, appeared no different in any of the walls they passed, no matter how her own image was altered. After many disorienting changes of route, including at least two occasions when Dimera's sense of direction insisted that they had doubled back or crossed over their own tracks, the ever-present background of screaming grew louder, and they passed into a small theatre. The mirrors were gone, although that did not mean reflective surfaces were absent. Dimera's face was all around her. In a glimpse from the door of an ominous-looking cabinet, or the momentary stare of her own eyes peering out from the flat of a blade. More important, however, was what was in front of her.
"Master Maculatix," Dimera said, ensuring her tone was loud enough to carry over the moans of agony, but still contained nothing but respect. Nothing more than respect. It did not do to let any homunculus detect servility in one's voice, but respect itself was key here in the heart of this creature's power. Maculatix turned, as though her presence was a surprise to him, instead of something of which he had been aware from the moment she arrived at the entrance to his realm.
"Lady Dimera, how delightful to lay eyes upon your flesh once more."
Maculatix had three eyes, in fact. Two more or less where you would expect them to be, in that they were either side of his nose and beneath his brow. One was no longer the dark, beady stare of his natural orbs, though, and was instead something larger, with a golden iris slashed with a pupil of narrow, ragged darkness. His other original eye, at least Dimera suspected it was his, although little was certain with a homunculus, now resided in his forehead, but not centrally. It was off to the left, above the golden eye, and was constantly in motion, independent of the other two. Nor did the master of the Red Harvest's modifications of his own body stop there. He had no fewer than four arms, and Dimera was not entirely certain that any of them were the ones he'd been born with, however many millennia ago that was. One was relatively normally proportioned until the fingers, the tips of which had been replaced with injector syringes to subdue his subjects, or indeed any enemy who strayed too close. Another ended in a nest of razor-sharp blades, suitable for amputation, vivisection, disemboweling or dismemberment, as the occasion demanded. The other two were more normal, with long, thin, delicate fingers that Dimera suspected would nevertheless possess a fearsome strength. It was these that Maculatix steepled in front of his chest as he looked down at her. He was not naturally the taller of the two of them. But like many homunculi, Maculatix did not debase himself by letting his feet touch the ground. Instead, he was borne aloft by suspensor technology that let him float imperiously around, like the sinister god Dimera imagined he considered himself to be.
If you have come to check on the progress of your brother, he has nearly recovered,
Maculatix said smoothly, floating to one side and letting Dimera get a proper look at the interior of his theatre. There were several operating slabs, but only one was currently occupied. Upon it, a purple-skinned biped of a species unfamiliar to Dimera writhed and wailed in agony as the menacing, glossy-shelled shape of a Talos pain engine hung over it with its limbs extended. Dimera caught the edge of the being's suffering. That delicious thrill which reinvigorated a Drukhari spirit and let them keep the fangs of She Who Thirsts at bay for just a little while longer. However, she was not the intended recipient of this feast. Suspended in the nurturing fluid of the reanimation pod that hung in the centre of the ceiling, her brother Dalgar twitched and spasmed as his body absorbed the life-giving agony from below. His body was properly formed again, Dimera observed, with its bones reset and flesh and muscle in place, and the last few pieces of skin growing back. There had been no shortage of raw material to work with. What remained of Dalgar's retainers had managed to retrieve most of his body from the wreckage in the aftermath of that disastrous encounter, but none of it had been in any condition to support life. Still, despite her brother's rashness, at least he'd had the sense to make his bargains with a homunculus of high renown before he was so careless as to allow the Arrakia to render him into paste. In times of war, the homunculus workshops might be full of reanimation pods, each one housing a fallen warrior who had paid their own price to be snatched back from the jaws of violent death to fight again. But Maculatix did not deal in such crass volumes. That was the role of his subordinates, homunculi of lesser craft who might resurrect 100 half-born Kalbalite warriors at a time into forms that were merely functional. Maculatix was an artist who specialised in returning his clients into a perfect recreation of their original body, or indeed an improvement upon it. The price, of course, was high. Dimera did not know what Dalgar had given up to the Master of the Red Harvest in order to ensure such assistance. Her own contract with Maculatix was one she would hesitate to call in, except in the direst need. Only at the moment of her death, or indeed immediately after it, were her retainers instructed to follow the resurrection protocols that would see her end up here.
Abrasion is the key in this case, Maculatix observed.
Two of his three eyes strained to the slab on which the torture was progressing.
This species has proven relatively resistant to the sharp pain of piercing or even flensing. However, low-grade abrasion of their dermal covering provides a far more satisfying result. Your brother should be whole again within another day cycle.
Your work is, as ever, exceptional, Dimera said politely.
It galled her to speak in such a manner to this floating corpse master, but such was the delicate balance of life and death in Port Tavar. Asdrubal Vect might speak as he pleased and slay whom he wanted, but Dimera Thrakes was no living muse. Not yet.
But I did not come here merely to discuss my brother's progress. After all, I would have no insight to offer that you did not already possess. I wish to speak of matters concerning power.
All three of Maculatix's eyes narrowed, and he flicked one finger in a dismissive gesture. The Rack who had led Dimera here withdrew, leaving the two of them alone apart from Dalgar, locked behind the walls of his reanimation pod, the Talos and its victim, who, Dimera suspected, had more immediate concerns than eavesdropping on such a conversation.
Power is a heady draft, Maculatix said, and definitions of it can vary wildly.
He is going to give me a self-aggrandizing speech about his power over death.
Dimera thought wearily, and immediately decided that she had no patience for it.
Then allow me to make my definition clear, Master Homunculus, she said quickly but smoothly. The political power of Port Tavar and our places within it.
The power of cabals, in other words,
Maculitix replied with a snort, but his eyes still held a flicker of attention. His disinterest was an affectation.
You know as well as I that the cabals provide the structure upon which our society operates,
Dimera said firmly.
And you also know, I am sure, that the current situation in Port Tavar advantages no one. The cabals are at each other's throats, clawing for dominance, and so all are suffering.
Spoken like someone who does not trade in the flesh of the dead and wounded,
Maculitix said, smiling. It was a thoroughly unnatural expression on his face and twisted his old leathery flesh into a disturbing rictus.
I do not doubt that such conflict benefits you, Dimera admitted. But what of the other impacts? Our real space raids are sparse, for we hesitate to weaken ourselves when our rivals are poised with blades bared. That limits the sport of the witch cults, for we have fewer prizes to trade with them for their gladiatorial games, and it reduces the number of interesting specimens for your collections. Where did you come by that bridge, for example?
She asked, nodding casually in the direction of the Talos' subject.
I am not without my own resources,
Maculitix said, a little defensively, and Dimera allowed herself a small smile.
Of course, Master Maculitix. You have your own vehicles and your own warriors who can sally forth into real space and do your bidding. But I think we both know that no matter how ferocious and resilient they are, your minions are limited to relatively small operations. Surgical strikes, one might say, which I have no doubt they perform with great ability. However, sometimes the greater prize requires a larger venture.
Flesh was the area of the Homunculus Coven's expertise, not hardware. Maculitix might possess raiders and venoms, but he had little access to larger craft like Boyd Ravens or Razor Wings, let alone ships capable of void travel. That limited him to predating on worlds which had their own webway gates, and that left a great deal of the galaxy out of his reach.
I presume you have a point, Master Archon,
Maculitix said, his tone sharpening a little. Dimera was unconcerned. This was a dance in which she had to demonstrate that she knew her own worth to him before any bargains could be struck.
Port Tavar needs authority,